Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have a very special guest. He's Morten Arison. He's a Canadian economist whose work and interests focus on portfolio management, investing, history, probability, and mathematics. He has worked in strategy consulting, private equity, and credit portfolio management. He's written a book called The Investing in the Age of Democracy. In that book, he explains how democracy, beginning with the American and French revolutions, shaped the way we currently invest in the 21st century. He proposes an alternative approach to investing based on four key features that are unique to the Austrian school of economics: class probability, the role of entrepreneurship and institutions, and the notion of intertemporal exchange. Followed to its ultimate consequences, these define a unique investing method. So what he's done is structured the book into 10 lessons where history, math, law, and economics mix to provide the reader with a rich perspective that stretches from ancient Rome's first investment vehicles to high-frequency trading in the 21st century. So we're going to explore that today with Morten. Welcome, Morten.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Richard. Pleasure.
Great. And you want to mention that you've been kind enough to put some notes together that we will put into an overall transcript once this podcast is published. So we'll have a transcript plus a podcast that people can either read or listen to the podcast or both. And just wondering a little bit about your background in economics, how you came to look at the world from an Austrian school of economics perspective.
Okay, so I was educated in economics. I have a bachelor's degree in economics, but it was only recently, a few years ago, that I became very interested in Austrian economics, and I went to the Auburn Conference of the Mises Institute in Auburn in 2011. And I did further research, and I really liked the work of a gentleman in Spain, Jesús Huerta de Soto, and he has written extensively about the issues of dynamics and coordination in markets and probability and so forth. And I being familiar with the Austrian school, I often heard that it is not clear whether one can say that there is a unique investing method that would sort of define Austrian economics in an applied way. So this book, it was a challenge for me. I was going through what I think are some pillars, some defining characteristics of the school of thought. And I think that if you follow them to the last consequence, you can actually organize a very rigorous, structured, consistent investment method that would be unique. And the book obviously asks why, if that is the case, market forces would have not led us there. And I argue that we would have been there had it not been for interventions, which are of a political nature and have a lot to do with the political developments that we have seen since the French and American revolutions. So broadly speaking, there were two trends. One was centralization, also sometimes understood as big government. It has been increasingly growing since then. And at the same time, scientism, which is a term that was sort of brought forward by Hayek, if I'm not mistaken, Friedrich von Hayek. And it consists of, mainly it describes the abuse of the scientific method, in this case applied to humanities. And these two have created a lot of situations, a lot of gave place to a lot of interventions by governments that, in a way, ended up taking us apart from this approach to investing.
And so what you've done is you've identified four elements from the Austrian School of Economics that yield a unique investment method, if you want to go into some detail on that.
Right, right. Probably I should expand a little bit more first on, you know, what each of the centralization and scientism did to the way we look at investing today, and how the pillars kind of define that method. So in terms of centralization, we have seen with increasing tax rates that we have experienced a loss in the savings capacity, particularly with the establishment 100 years ago, or approximately, or even more, of income taxes. And that's something that began in a few countries, and now it's something widespread all over the world. Then, in parallel to that, we have suffered the loss of private money, also called gold, which was also a very slow process that began in 1913 with the creation of the Federal Reserve, and then in 1933 with the exportation of gold in the United States, and then we had a system, the gold exchange standard, that lasted until 1971, and from then on, we have been basically on fiat currency. That also led to a misunderstanding of the concept of liquidity. I think this is important. I'm going to put a few minutes here.
Sure. Yeah.
The way people look at liquidity today is as if it was an intrinsic characteristic of an asset. So people can say, well, this bond is liquid, this stock is liquid. Yet if you look at the way we used to see it, even until 1936, John Maynard Keynes, who was obviously not an Austrian, he referred to the concept of liquidity preference. So we do have a liquidity preference, which is a preference to be liquid and to own money, which is an asset that sort of protects us from uncertainty. At the same time, the concept that liquidity is, the notion of liquidity is characteristic to an asset, unfortunately, was kind of suggested by Karl Menger, who was an Austrian. He called that in his works Marktgängigkeit, which was sort of marketability. And from then on, it was corrupted. And today we understand liquidity as the capacity of an asset to be traded with credit. We say that a market is liquid. What we are saying today is that there's enough credit in that market to trade an asset, even though as a counterpart, we don't have true savings supporting that. And that is very important, because then that creates a distortion that shouldn't be. I mean, if you want to be liquid, the Austrians would say, just own money. That is the instrument that you need to be liquid. And then from then on, if you want to invest in capital assets. But the corruption of the concept of liquidity led us to mix everything, money and capital, and create degrees of liquidity in them, and force us kind of to think in terms of paying for risk premium, when in fact there's an asset available to us at every time, which is money. That too, because money began to be sort of created by the expansion of fiscal deficits, led us to the misunderstanding of sovereign risk as well. And it's something I discuss in the book. But all of that together created a distortion in favor of public securities versus private securities, the creation of Ponzi's, and with central banks, systemic risk, and at the private level, the rationalization of all that under modern portfolio management, the theory of modern portfolio management. And this is, all of these is a product of that movement in centralization that we have experienced, or big government that we have experienced since 1780s. In terms of scientism, which a few minutes ago I described as the abuse of the scientific method applied to humanities. You can see that, particularly after the 1870s, with Valras, you have seen infinitesimal analysis, general equilibrium, and the use of probability, and the mechanistic view of interest rates that Austrians considered as intertemporal exchange rates rather than as productivity rates, apply to the evaluation of securities, which are actually property titles on entrepreneurial processes, so to speak. So all of that together took us to where we are today. So, however, I think that we can make a pause here and think in terms of the four pillars of the Austrian School of Economics. One of them, I think, the most important is entrepreneurship, the role of entrepreneurship. It is completely ignored in mainstream economics. There's no place for that because mainly it cannot be formalized, and that is seen as a disadvantage rather than being considered on a factual basis. I mean, there's no reason to believe that it is better or not to mathematize entrepreneurship. And somebody a few years ago did published an article on a Spanish magazine, Procesos de Mercado, edited by Jesús Huerta de Soto, proposing a way to establish whether or not entrepreneurship could be formalized. And he concluded that it cannot, that because it's non-recursive, it cannot. And so why do I bring this up? Because if you think that if you establish that human action cannot be mathematized, entrepreneurship cannot be mathematized, then there's no point in saying that you can value equity, which is a property title on said entrepreneurship. And that has profound consequences because if you cannot value that, if it's up to the risk management of the entrepreneur, the immediate direct consequence of that is to say that if you're going to invest in equity, you should invest in private equity because it's something that you can manage. It's a risk that you can manage. It's an uncertainty on which you have certain control. And that is not the case, obviously, with public equity. And one of the things I bring up in the book is that at the time of Adam Smith, with the beginning of the concept of limited liability, there was an enormous debate on whether it was advantageous or not for investing. One of the distortions that took us out from the field of private equity that was predominant, I would say, since the fall of the Roman Empire to the times of the trading companies in Holland was private equity. And it was at the beginning of the trading expansion of Holland that lawyers like Grotius brought up the issue of changing the status quo and establishing the concept of limited liability. There was a lot of reaction against that at the time, and it had to be imposed. And because it was imposed and it was properly seen as a privilege, the monarch that did that charged a fee on that privilege. And I would say it stood that way, it stayed that way until the mid-19th century, when increasingly in the United States, it was seen as necessary to fund more ventures. But like I say, it's something very, very recent, and it has created a distortion in terms of favoring public equity versus private. And at the same time, if you add the other intervention, which is the banning on insider trading, which is it takes a signal out of the market, it creates the illusion that there is no such a thing as inside information. It also unlevels the field of private equity versus public equities. So this would be one of the first pillars, the idea of entrepreneurship, that if you think in the Austrian way, initially you think that the best case for you as an investor is always to go for private equity. The other one is the concept of probability. One of the I think it's a key characteristic of Austrian School of Economics to distinguish between case and class probability. In class probability, the concept of class probability was actually the mainstream concept of probability up until the 1920s. And I'm going to try to be brief here, but it basically was probability that you can think in terms of when you roll the dice, limited spaces, you know the outcomes. And Richard von Mises, who was the brother of Ludwig von Mises, wrote a book called Probability Statistics and Truth that I think was published in 1928. And he made the case that that is the only time when one can speak of probability correctly, appropriately. One can use it. And that means that in order to do so, you have to identify a collective, a group of elements, or in this case, companies, right, if you want. And they have to behave in a homogeneous way and converge to a number that you may be looking at, right? Let's say a return or a ratio. And most importantly, whenever you take different time frames to see that convergence take place, regardless of which time frame you take, you still see that trend taking place, right? And if you apply that to investing, you will realize that since entrepreneurship is unique, there are unique markets, unique companies with unique management, unique capital structures, it's impossible to apply probability theory because you can speak of an asset class called equity versus an asset class called debt. And yes, you can say that the convergence of the net returns should be positive. Otherwise, there would be no entrepreneurships because entrepreneurs, otherwise, they would be always bankrupt. But besides that, I cannot think of any other case. And the proof of that is that rating agencies sell every month updated tables on, for instance, migration in risk ratings, right? If you could apply probability theory, regardless of which time frame you see, probabilities of default for, let's say, companies with similar debt to equity or similar net debt to EBITDA ratios should not change, but the fact is that they do change, and I'm not surprised in that. It's just that with that scientist approach, with that search for perfect information, run into the illusion that we can use it. But it was a movement that began with Keynes in the 1920s, a book called The Theory of Probability, and it has really shaped the way we look at modern. Look at portfolio management today. If you use a Bloomberg terminal and you try to value any security that would be a derivative or any structured product, you will immediately see that probability is used without thinking, without a pause. Right? I mean, it's just something very direct. And the fact that you, if you use the other concept, the Austrian concept of class probability, you realize that unless you actually have control over that security that you want to own for your investment purposes, there's no point in trying to forecast the probability of something happening because effectively you have no control. There's no way. I mean, you're running into a tautology where you tell yourself, if such and such a thing happens, I will get this outcome. But I mean, that adds no insights, no further information. So I don't know if you have any questions or if you want, I can go to the two other pillars of.
Oh, yeah, sure. So we've covered far entrepreneurship and sort of the correct theory of probability. And we have two more institutions and money, capital, and interest rate. Yeah, go ahead on those two. Yeah.
Yeah, so in terms of the institutions, I mean, I think the Austrians have an advantage because they can understand the institutional context in which investment takes place. And there are there are very important institutions like a deposit and a loan that the oceans can distinguish. They understand that a deposit is not a loan, and that fractional reserve banking sort of corrupts the concept today. They understand what is money and what is not, and the qualities that money has to have, and gold is money, so to speak, because it has all those qualities. If you look at, for instance, virtual currencies, I believe that virtual currencies lack two qualities that are quite necessary, I mean, fundamental to money. One of them is fungibility, since Bitcoin, by definition, is a ledger, right? A distributed ledger.
Yeah, but
never
on the
fungibility.
Sorry, just to clarify.
Never be fungibility.
The virtual currencies, you're meaning the cryptocurrencies, right, such as Bitcoin and Ether.
Right.
Okay, yeah,
right.
Just to be clear. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
So those cryptocurrencies that are distributed ledgers, and there's a reason why that happens, because they are not redeemable, right? So the two characteristics that define money, I mean, there are more, but these are fundamental to money, are fungibility and redeemability. And by definition, virtual currencies or cryptocurrencies are not redeemable. You cannot redeem them into any, you can change them. You can use them as an indirect medium of exchange, but you can never redeem them themselves. Fiat currency you can do. You get the physical paper bill. Gold you can do. You get the metal. But that's not the case. And because possession is not there to show ownership, ownership has to be established via the distributed ledger. And that institution, if you want, because it has been a spontaneous creation of the market, cannot benefit from fungibility by definition, because at any point you know what belongs to whom,
yeah.
Right? So there can never be an established capital market in that sense. And as far as I know, so for at least to date, the only intertemporal exchange is peer-to-peer, right? In which some savings are from, exchanged from one participant to the other, but not to a central institution that collects and then distributes. That is intrinsic to that, to virtual currencies, because, precisely because my understanding is that those who created them, actually wanted to avoid that centralization. But the banking has a role, right? I mean, there's a lot of information to be discovered about those saving and those demanding those savings, and it's it has value. And banking itself is an institution that has been documented at least since the time of the ancient Greece. So without a fungibility, you can never have capital markets and cryptocurrencies. And at the same time, without the redeemability, if there ever is any sort of expansion via a trade multiplier, it will have to be unchecked by definition too, because there will be never any run on any Bitcoin banks, for example. And eventually, Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency that advances to that stage would devalue, defeating its own purpose, right? Because the trade multiplier would affect an expansion that was not thought of by the creators of the cryptocurrency. So if you want, in a way you can say that Austrian investing is an arbitrage, institutional arbitrage, because you're always understanding loopholes, interventions on market-driven creations, institutions, and you arbitrage and sell the bad ones to buy the good ones. You could say the same about structured investments. You'd say the same within the space of currencies, right? You're arbitraging certain features, right? Usually we, scarcity being one of them, we arbitrage scarcity when you see that the currency expands more than another, you're arbitraging scarcity. If you have a problem with, if you need to take capital out of a jurisdiction that is pretty restrictive, you're arbitraging redeemability. And that's where Bitcoin gets its value, I think, right? Because it's less redeemable and at the same time less sizable by the authorities, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's also the issue of public institutions where you recognize, if you are into the Austrian School of Economics, I mean, you recognize failures in public institutions. One of them is the Eurozone, where mainstream economists took the last Euro crisis as a liquidity crisis, while Austrian economists understood that it was an institutional problem, and that was the fact that there's no unified bond market in the Eurozone. And the last but not least important of all the pillars is the understanding of what is money and what is capital that is lacking in mainstream economics, and that interest rate is actually an institution too, whose function is to allow the intertemporal exchange of resources between people. And the direct consequence of understanding that is that it allows you to differentiate when you invest and when you trade. And when you invest is when you exchange your money for capital assets. And so with the derivatives that are not used for hedging, for instance, or commodities or fiat currencies, you're not investing. They don't yield any produce. And that's the same case for gold. So an Austrian would say that you do not invest in gold. You exchange a fiat currency, one currency for the other one. And there's also another direct consequence of understanding what an interest rate is, which is that asset allocation is nothing but else but intertemporal preference. So there's a direct connection between your intertemporal preference and the way you allocate your assets, whether you want growth or not. And then if you want growth, you need, like I said, to invest in equity in entrepreneurial projects. And if not, if you want yield, obviously you will go for another part of the capital structure for debt. And being a subjective exchange, I mean, that intertemporal exchange is completely subjective. There's no point in trying to benchmark yourself against indices in terms of returns, and you have to target your absolute returns, the ones you're comfortable with, and the ones that are consistent with your liquidity preference. And I'm going back to the concept of liquidity. So I see that when you put all these four pillars together, the correct understanding of the theory of probability, the correct understanding of the role of entrepreneurs, the correct understanding of the role of institutions, and the correct distinction between money and capital, and understanding of interest rates, then you come up with a particular method that would say to you, well, you need to think of investing not in terms not in the terms that you have seen until now, when you have one big diversified portfolio that tries to be optimized in terms of risk and returns, with minimizing risk and maximizing returns, and you shouldn't be paying a premium for liquidity. You shouldn't mix public and private securities. You shouldn't even try to do any value investing, because it's a tautology. You will never be able to really know the value of any entrepreneurial project unless you have control on it. And then the first thing that you should do is to define your liquidity needs, your liquidity preference, and separate that into a liquidity portfolio. And then the second one is, once you establish, again, your intertemporal preference, you look for a certain component of growth and a certain component of yield. And that growth will be represented by equity, but you have to prioritize private equity. And in terms of debt, the same happens, right? One should prioritize bilateral loans, right? But again, the book goes to explain all the distortions that we have suffered that have made the use of bilateral loans, like would be, you know, lending somebody directly with a mortgage, via mortgage, right? That took us away from that. And so we're left with public securities, public equity, and let's say public bonds, right? And we're constantly benchmarked against indices. And there's another interesting thing. I mean, if you recognize the fact that final value increases with time, right? The direct consequence of that too is to think that most of the time in mainstream investing theory, the recommendation comes that when you're young, you should try to go for as much equity as you can, as much growth as you can in your investments, because only after when you are established, you need a stable cash flow. But if you think of that, you're putting yourself to an enormous amount of risk, uncertainty in securities over which you have no control, and you lose an enormous amount of compounded value. So I think that when you go through all this thinking in terms of how to approach your investment, one conclusion is that the longer your term horizon, that means the younger you are, the less you have to invest in equity. The more you have to invest in computable risk that can compound, okay, in things that you can manage. And there were a lot of institutions that we had created before this big increase in government. One of them was the annuity business by the insurance companies, right? That was a legitimate market-driven, spontaneous invention. But today we don't have that, and with the distortion interest rates, it's very expensive if you try to go that way. And so again, I mean, the younger you are, the more you have to allow for that component to work for you. And only when you're getting older and you see that you don't get to your target in terms of savings, then you can start risking something, which is complete counterintuitive versus what the common knowledge says, right? So, and after all, I mean, I devote, yes, the last third of the book, to discuss the proper micro themes in Austrian economics. But as you can see, up until now, we've just discussed very specific themes that have nothing to do. I mean, they have to, but I mean, I haven't gone properly to discuss any micro. One of them, I think the most important, is systemic risk. And in a chapter where I go to show that, I mean, that there is no such a thing as systemic risk. It's just the natural outcome of the interventions in the market by central banks. I mean, the fact that we don't know when it's going to happen doesn't mean it is a risk. I mean, it is there. We know its causes, and we know how the process works, the coupling between central bank works, which I described in the chapter via the explanation of cross-currency swaps. And I recommend that after you have established your three portfolios, the liquidity, the equity, and the debt portfolios, one can think in terms of an aggregate hedge against that systemic risk at the portfolio level. And that could sort of address the mainstream view that you have to pay for a premium for liquidity. An alternative could be that you do not, that you just, again, separate whatever liquidity you need under your liquidity portfolio. And then once you have established your investing portfolios, you put a hedge against systemic risk for them to protect them.
And how do you do that exactly, like in terms of applying?
Well, in the case of Canada, I mean, again, I think it is an institutional thing. If you look at this is just my own opinion. In the case of Canada, that hedge was the exchange rate between the U.S. dollar and the Canadian dollar. So, if you as you see increasing systemic risk, let's say in this particular country, this particular moment, through the increase in risk from the real estate market, I think that that will be translated into sovereign risk, and it will push the monetary authorities to devalue the Canadian dollar. And so if you can be long an instrument that would capture that and would have some convexity properties in that sense, then you're doing exactly that, right?
And just a couple of questions on You mentioned on the equity portfolio that you should prioritize private equity. How do you go about doing that in terms of the prioritization process?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, you mentioned on for the equity portfolio, one of the three portfolios, the suggestion is to prioritize private equity. Process to do that.
I think the simplest way to do that, which is accessible to everybody, is to buy a property today, right? But that has been completely intervened today by the government. I mean, there's this push from the government to take you away from any way out. I mean, to take you away from any safe haven assets, right? Because when you buy a property for investing purposes, obviously you in one, you know, with one transaction, you are first avoiding fractional reserve or rehypothecation of the assets, because it cannot be two similar assets on the same location, because you're buying location. And then you're free to manage. You have a lot of latitude in terms of managing, in terms of having control over that. But, you know, real capital assets, at another way, and I have a chapter devoted to them, but I think the conclusion in the book is that there's never a definitive answer to that. I mean, and that's very intrinsic to Austrian economics, the notion that there's never equilibrium, that you're always in danger, that you have always to look out for opportunities and for future problems, right? So, like I said, there may be multiple real capital assets. You can have, again, property, you can have cattle, you can have wine if you want, you can have forestry, you can have farmland, and all of them, you know, they serve a purpose at a specific time within a crisis. For instance, in terms of farmland, it's not a hedge against crisis forever. It's not, I mean, it will be your equity investment, but, you know, to a certain extent, if things go really bad, you will be stuck with an immovable asset, a very easily taxable asset, right? And, so again, as I provide sort of, examples of ways in which you can, invest in private equity, there's never any safe haven asset.
And in terms of public equity, is your suggestion to diversify due to the non-computable risk?
Yes and no. I mean, yes, but if you said that, then people could say, well, I mean, anybody could argue, well, then you're saying the same as mainstream economics. And here's a thing. I mean, in mainstream economics, the exercise of diversification is against, you know, they have what they call a systemic risk component that they claim to be able to measure from observations on what they call risk-free assets, like sovereign bonds, right? And that diversification comes from the measurement of the sigma, the volatility of other assets and their correlation and so on, which again, they go in circularity because they assume that past performance will be something that you can project into the future. And you have to make a lot of assumptions that just revolve around themselves. Well, what I'm saying is, yes, you have to diversify, but only because you know nothing. I mean, you absolutely know nothing, and the shot can come from anywhere. And if you tell yourself that you need 20 securities to be diversified, well, you're kidding yourself. That's not the case. I mean, if these are subject to a currency zone, if they're denominated in a currency that, because of institutional problems, because the central bank is too weak, are prone to suffer from, you know, a devaluation, then, you know, there's no remedy to that. So the diversification comes only as a consequence of the recognition of our ignorance, but only that. I mean, I cannot provide you with a specific number. I cannot say, you know, you can reduce. Obviously, the general idea is that all things equal, which is what mainstream economists say. All things equal, the more assets that you have, the better, right? But that is not necessarily true, and that's a very subjective exercise, right?
Yeah. A last question is on, you mentioned there's three macro themes, how Austrian economics has a unique approach to these three macro themes. Can you briefly touch on the inflation, hyperinflation macro theme?
Yeah, sure. So obviously the general notion of inflation within mainstream economists is that you have something that is observable, that is a vector, which I call an index of prices, and that inflation is neutral, that this level comes up or down, but in terms of monetary expansions or reductions. But as an Austrian, you recognize two things. First, that it is not neutral, absolutely not. And the reason that money expansion is not neutral is precisely what motivates monetary authorities to create inflation, okay? And the second thing is that there's this notion that hyperinflation is simply an arbitrary high number in terms of inflation. And that is not the case. Hyperinflation is simply, it's not quantitative. That's sort of my point. Hyperinflation is a qualitative phenomenon, and it is one in which the central bank finds itself defenseless. In a circularity where they're forced to issue an interest-paying liability that is more expensive than whatever interest that is higher. I mean, the interest that they pay on that liability is higher than any interest they receive on their assets. So that deficit, which is called quasi-fiscal deficit, can only be covered by monetizing and by printing money to pay that net interest. And then again, in order to take that money that the central bank has put just put into circulation, what they have to do is increase the rate. I mean, they have to what is called sterilization of the, you know, they have to sterilize that money that they just printed at a higher rate, which simply enhances that circularity. Today, right now, as we speak, there's one country that is suffering from that, and that is Argentina, with an instrument called Lebacs, and the central bank is paying someone like, it began paying something like 38% a year ago. It's around the high 20s now. And unless they have the fiscal deficit in control in Argentina, that will spiral out of control. Okay, wow. So even though you don't see inflation in the hundreds like you used to in the 80s maybe, the fact is right now that central bank is out of control. And they're in the early stages of a hyperinflationary process. What about us in the first world? Well, if you think that, what matters here, like I said, is the relation between the interest income received by the central bank on its assets and what they have to pay. And it doesn't have to be too high. I mean, I have mentioned Argentina paying 25%, but what if there was a problem? If there was a sovereign problem in the Eurozone, and all of a sudden the central bank had to replace sovereign bonds with their own liabilities, right? Right now what they do is they collateralize that sovereign debt. But what if they had to actually replace it, right, with their own liability, but with an interest-paying liability? On the one hand, they have, like any other central bank, money supply, which bears no interest, and then they have to pay. Even if they had to pay 25 bips, those 25 bips will have to be monetized, right? So right there, you have hyperinflation. And I think that one has to pay close attention to that. Only if you understand that, you will see how, we're at the early stages of a hyperinflationary, in my opinion, period now. But again, that means that, again, you have to understand that it is loss of control by the central bank and not just the inflation rate on its own.
Okay. Well, Morten, great insight in economics and investing. How can our listeners learn more about getting access to your book, Investing in the Age of Democracy?
The book is already available now on Amazon. It's under the title Investing in the Age of Democracy. And soon, probably, I mean, I haven't had the time yet, but I intend to put it on its digital format for Kindle.
Great. We'll look forward to that. Thank you very much, Morten, for being on the show.
You're very welcome.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.